Hello, and welcome to KVRU 105.7's The Forecast, Seattle's weekly women's sports show. I'm your host, Maggie Mertens. The Forecast is a new show here on KVRU where we're taking traditional sports radio and turning it on its head. That means we're here to cover the women's sports scene here in Seattle. We love you, Mariners, Seahawks, Sounders, and Kraken, but honestly, you guys get enough coverage. This show will be all about the Seattle Storm, the Rain, and the Torrent. Hence our name, The Forecast, and all of the other incredible women athletes here in the Seattle area. We're talking Salmon Bay FC, Seattle Majestics, Rat City Roller Girls, the Seattle Riot, the Seattle Tempest, and of course, our local college athletes, the Huskies, the Redhawks, and many more. We want to broaden the horizons of what it means to cover sports here in Seattle, and we can't wait to get started. I'm a freelance journalist who's been writing about women athletes, sports, and culture for the past decade, and I'm tired of seeing women's sports be treated as second class. So here on The Forecast, they're always going to be the main event. My producer, Jeff Shaw, is the other half of this operation. Jeff and I have worked together on stories about women athletes for several years now. He's a cinematographer and photographer who cares deeply about telling the stories that otherwise go uncovered. Together with the support of KVRU, we're going to create a new kind of sports radio and tell the stories that we want to hear more of. So on today's show, we're going to have a recap. We'll bring you the biggest scores and headlines from the women's sports teams and athletes here in Seattle, including a peek at what's been going on at the Winter Olympics. We're going to have some hot takes, our own opinions on women's sports news that you may or may not agree with. Then we're going to hear from one of the Olympic athletes competing now with roots here in Seattle, Eunice Lee. Next, we'll get to know the newest team in town, the Seattle Torrent. And I may or may not diss the Kraken. Finally, we'll wrap up with an interview with independent journalist Frankie De La Creta about some connections between the PWHL and the protests going on against ICE. We're still figuring all of this out, but in short, each week we'll devote the first half of our show to all the biggest scores, headlines, and news from Seattle's women's sports scene, and the second half to in-depth interviews, conversations, and reported stories that take the listener deeper into a topic. Let's jump right in. This week we were watching a lot of USA hockey. They're in their early rounds over in the Olympics, and the women are on a roll. They beat Czechia 5-1 with two goals by Seattle Torrent players, the first by Alex Carpenter, the second by Captain Hillary Knight. Torrent defender Aneta Terjolova was also on the ice for Team Czechia. Later, they beat Finland 5-0 with another Knight goal and another Carpenter goal. Torrents are really showing up here. Another blowout. They outshot the Finns 49-11. So this week on Tuesday, Team USA is going to be taking on their big rivals, Canada. And we'll all be watching that because that might get a little testy. Forward for the Seattle Torrent, Julia Gosling, in fact, is going to be playing for Team Canada. So we're going to be watching how she interacts with her Seattle Torrent teammates, Alex Carpenter, Hillary Knight, Hannah Bilka, and Kayla Barnes over on Team USA. There was one other Seattle area connection during the Olympics this weekend. Skier Breezy Johnson won the gold in the downhill with just an incredible run and a gorgeous story. She was injured and unable to participate in 2022 in Beijing. This was a real redemption story for her. And she is a Western Washington University graduate, which I only learned this weekend. And we are happy to claim her and her gold medal. Next, we are looking at college basketball because we are heading into March Madness season very soon. Unfortunately, the University of Washington Huskies lost to Ohio State last Thursday. It was a close game, 70-60. I wasn't there, but Jeff, our producer, was. Jeff, do you have any notes from the game?
It's so frustrating. And I often think that people think that basketball doesn't exist in this town when the Sonics aren't here or when UW Husky men's basketball is not winning. Mm-hmm. And I so desperately wanted the women to beat Ohio State at home and prove the point that they are the best basketball team in the city. Mm-hmm. They did not. You were at a game a couple days prior, and I think it was a very similar experience for you where like they got blown out.
Yeah.
at home.
Yeah, yeah. And you kind of knew that they just weren't up to their best selves, right? They weren't just playing their best game that they could have been playing. It is always disappointing. It's also, whenever I watch college sports, it's just such a reminder that, like, these kids are so young and there's so much to learn. And, you know, like, you have no idea what it's going to be like next year, right? They could all just, like, completely take off.
Totally. I think the challenge for the University of Washington is this feels a little bit like their make it or break it season. They made the tournament last year. You know, they squeezed out an overtime win against Wisconsin yesterday night. So that would be Monday. No, sorry, Sunday. So they, you know, the Super Bowl was happening. And part of the reason why my day was so busy yesterday was because at noon we had to watch women's Husky basketball go to overtime in Wisconsin and barely squeeze out a win that they should have won by 15 or 20. And
yeah,
they only won by 4 in overtime.
Yeah.
But on Wednesday night, February the 11th, they are playing at Iowa, which is a big test for them.
Yeah.
Iowa's been ranked in the top 10 at points during the season. They're currently ranked 15th. But I just think, like, I know some people don't like to put pressure on these college students. I kind of want to apply the pressure and be like, they are good enough that they should not be middle of the pack in the Big Ten.
Mm-hmm.
They should expect to win a couple games, if not more. I think they could easily be a Sweet 16 team in the tournament, but they got to win some games.
Yeah, yeah. And it sounds like they've had the season that, you know, we know how this goes. Sometimes you beat the teams you're not expected to beat, and you lose to the teams you're supposed to beat. And I think that's also just a total mentality issue, right? Like, you know, you have the talent to win those big games, but, you know, we see that the Storm does that sometimes too. It's so frustrating, right? When you're like, oh, we know we're going to win this one. It's a gimme. And that's the one that they just, like, get blown out. And then on the ones that, you know, they're playing the number one team, they bring it all, put it all on the floor, and you're just like, this is insane. Of course we're this good.
Yeah, and I think sometimes you get a little ahead of yourself and you look at, you know, we're all starting to look at March Madness, what's coming. This week is a big week for them. They do play Oregon twice, and I will say that Oregon women's basketball is not very good this year.
They are not.
So they might be looking ahead and saying that they have a couple wins, but they play Iowa, then they play Oregon, and then they go to UCLA, and UCLA is really good.
Right, right.
And so I just think, like, Wednesday night, we're going to really see if they show up. They tend to show up kind of in these, like,
yeah,
bigger
tough
games.
Spots.
But they don't. So, like, maybe they can beat Iowa or play Iowa close, and maybe they lose a game at Oregon.
Maybe they're saving it all for UCLA.
I know. But it just is, like, one of those things, like, we don't know if – you know, this is here nor there, but we don't know if the CBA is going to be signed and the Storm are going to be playing this year. But, like, Husky women's basketball should be in the tournament, and the city should be pumped to actually watch a good basketball team win a couple games in the tournament. So,
yeah,
we'll see what happens this week.
All right. The other... Then we'll move over to the other basketball tournament that's been going on, Unrivaled. They play their games over the weekend, and on Friday and Saturday, we got to see Breeze versus Hive. I'm pulling for the Breeze this season, and they lost to the Hive in dramatic fashion, allowing the Hive to make the biggest comeback in Unrivaled history. Hive put up 27 points in the third quarter, coming back from a 15-point deficit. They ended up winning 70-68. Honestly, I'm not super surprised hearing about this, just because Sonia Citron has looked amazing this Unrivaled season. She is so good and so fun to watch. The Lunar Owls fell to the Laces 70-74. Storm forward Brittany Sykes. Is she a forward?
Yeah.
Okay. Storm forward Brittany Sykes got the game winner there for the Laces. And Rose versus the Vinyl. Chelsea Gray's Rose beat the Vinyl 74-66. The Vinyl, too, have been so fun to watch for me. Brittany Griner is just having so much fun this Unrivaled season, and I just really love to see that. Lastly, the Phantom versus the Mist. The Phantom ended up on top 83-71. We love to see Kelsey Plum and Natasha Cloud and Aaliyah Boston going off for the Phantom. Then I could talk about the Breeze.
Yeah.
Should I talk about him? Personally, I've got my eyes on the Breeze this unrivaled season, mostly because ex-Storm coach Noel Quinn is coaching Dominique Malonga, the Storm rookie who has everybody watching her, along with several players who I wish were on the Storm, like Paige Beckers, Cam Brink, and Rikia Jackson, plus Kate Martin, who's just always so scrappy and fun to watch. Unfortunately, Ari McDonald was playing injured, and she's now been ruled out for the rest of the unrivaled season. But it was just announced that Courtney Williams is going to be traded to the Breeze to replace Ari, which is great.
It feels a little. How would you say this? Like, the Breeze are your team, but it feels a little bittersweet.
Mm-hmm.
Because we get to watch Noel Quinn.
Yeah, we should say something about that.
Like, yeah. I mean, I'm just, yeah, we're, yeah, having the conversation. Like,
Yeah.
It feels bittersweet that Noel Quinn, who I really like, I don't know if she's a good WNBA basketball coach,
mm-hmm,
but Noel Quinn is getting to coach Malonga, yeah, with, yeah, Paige, Brink, Rikia Jackson, and now has Courtney Williams.
Yes. Yeah, I think it's like, that's just, for me, it's kind of redemption story for Noel Quinn. It's also, you know, there was so much talk about Quinn as a coach. Rumors and speculation abounded about, you know, what that was like and whether it was her or the team that, you know, just kind of kept dropping the ball, so to speak, over the last couple seasons. And, you know, I am kind of hopefully watching to see her kind of pull something out and prove herself as a coach. And maybe, you know, this format is also better for her. It's been really awesome to see all the different styles and types of coaches that Unrivaled has brought in. And that's just been really fun, too, to get to know, like, some of the people in the universe there.
Totally. And I think watching Malonga and Paige,
mm-hmm,
on a pick and roll,
yes,
is absolutely fascinating.
Yes.
And why... I mean, I don't know who's going to be back for the Storm, but, like,
yeah,
why would you not want something like that,
yeah,
in Seattle?
Yeah.
You know, whether it's a Kelsey Plum or a Paige, mm, or whatever, but you just see that, like I've seen the highlights of her throwing lobs to Malonga,
mm-hmm,
in practice.
Mm-hmm.
They've played really well. It also maybe should go, you know, shouldn't go unsaid that, like, they did fade at the end of the game. And I don't,
did,
you know, Storm fans sort of know some of that pain. So,
yes, exactly, right? So what are we seeing here? Is it going to be like Storm 2.0, or are we going to see something kind of new and different and exciting? Just watching Malonga play, I mean, we got to see her just grow so much over the last Storm season, and seeing her in this format too, it's just so incredible. And I love watching young players develop and, you know, gain confidence, and, you know, being able to play with lots of different types of people is a huge part of that. So this is probably really, really great for her development.
And now to your sad news.
Yeah, I was actually super shook up this weekend, yesterday, hearing about Rikia Jackson's ex-boyfriend, a defensive end for the Atlanta Falcons. He was arrested for domestic abuse and battery over the weekend. The story's pretty upsetting. He, you know, ended up kind of in a police chase and using his car to run into Jackson's car. The teams and league have put out some statements, you know, hoping for the best for Rikia. This happened after the Breeze game as well the next day. And just Canada's probably going through. And it makes me really sad hearing about it on Super Bowl Sunday, you know, thinking about the pattern of violence and abuse that, you know, continues to happen with NFL players and largely goes, you know, kind of unchecked and unhelped. It's a big reason I have kind of not been able to support the NFL in recent years. It's just something that I hate seeing over and over and over again. Just does not take violence against women seriously.
Is there an answer to that?
I mean, look, there's so many things wrong with the NFL when it comes to protecting people, even protecting their own players. And, you know, we kind of look at these people as gladiators and say sort of whatever it takes for the win. And yeah, I mean, what they really need is stronger protections and stronger support for people who might be channeling that energy in the wrong way. And also, you know, I mean, just in general in this country, domestic abuse is such a huge, huge problem. And when you put it on this pedestal of, you know, letting people in these elite parts of our society, like professional athletes, sort of just get slapped on the wrist, or, you know, being allowed to come back to work. It doesn't really help the situation.
Yeah. And I hope, you know, maybe to that kind of point, like with Rekia being a part of Unrivaled, there's the getting to train and be around folks during the off season. You know, it's not really truly off season because they're getting paid and playing, but like, hopefully there's a way that then those players can support each other in a different way. You know, instead of scattering, you know,
totally.
WNBA season ends, you scatter, you go do your own thing. Maybe there's some communal support that can really be helpful there.
Mm-hmm.
Because that is such a terrible situation.
Yeah. No, I mean, it's a huge help for anyone who's experienced abuse, you know, having people around you who are supportive and who you can turn to. Is really important. And I mean, this is one of the things that I love about Unrivaled is you are seeing, you know, those relationships kind of blossom, you know, within teammates, of course, but then, you know, cross teams as well. And you just have these sort of this ability, to spend more time together and to get to know each other in these different ways and support each other as people, which I think is also sort of why these basketball players are such forces to be reckoned with, right, in the real world, and are doing such a great job as a union and all of that, too. All right, let's move on to our hot takes of the week. Jeff, what do you have for us this week?
Speaking of Unrivaled and basketball, and I don't know if it's that surprising, but I do not think that there's a WNBA season. I don't think there's a CBA that's going to be done, and I don't think that that there's going to be a season.
Mm-hmm. I'm worried. I will admit I'm worried. I don't know that I feel confident that it's not going to happen. You know, they did. WNBA finally came back with another contract option over the weekend. They are looking at it, the Players Association. So, you know, I'm hopeful, but I also would not be surprised to see it, you know, end up a strike. They are at their most powerful, right? And it just does not seem like the league wants to play.
And it just feels like, I know it's very different. It's very different than what happened during COVID and some of the Black Lives Matter movement and what the W did when they're kind of in the wobble. Mm-hmm. But I just think like you have all these players hanging out, training, mm-hmm. playing together.
Mm-hmm.
You know that there's conversations going on.
Oh, yeah.
You have situations where they're going and playing games in Philly mm-hmm. and publicizing how much money the league is making from one, you know, showing in Philly. And then you have the W representation not totally coming prepared.
Yeah. Crying and, poor, too.
Yeah.
Right?
And so I just think, like, of all the times, you know, a little bit like there's support in numbers, like they're all together. So I'm just going to be really curious, you know, really the W can release their schedule. It can be like the Storm release their schedule. It was like such a weird version of seeing the schedule go out.
Yeah.
You know, they can try to pump it up, but like, I just don't see it. I don't see the pieces falling into place.
Yeah. I mean, I will be surprised if it's on time. I will definitely put it that way.
But I also know you have a hot take that is a little different and more Olympic related.
Yes. Yeah. No, my hot take is I have been so surprised, and in a really good way, a really pleasant way, how many Team USA athletes have been speaking out politically about the situation in the U.S. right now, especially regarding ICE. and the violence that we're seeing, the dehumanization that's been going on, you know, just about immigrants and people of color in this country. And, you know, it used to be if you were at the Olympics, like, you were not speaking badly about the flag, right? You're not speaking badly about this country. You know, we've had gymnasts be dressed down for not, like, holding their hand over their heart during the anthem, things like that. Every tiny thing kind of gets picked apart. And, you know, with things being just so horribly hard as they are currently in the United States, I've just been really amazed that so many athletes are speaking out and really at their own risk. We've seen skiers like Jesse Diggins, Chloe Kim, the snowboarder, Michaela Schifrin has spoken out, Amber Glenn, the figure skater. I've seen messages from, you know, our President Trump is not holding back from taking these people to task. And it really reminded me of the moment when Megan Rapinoe was speaking out against the Trump administration 1.0 during the World Cup, and, you know, while competing wearing a USA jersey and being spoken about terribly by the president of the United States, and, you know, still going on to win and, you know, really taking that seriously, as, you know, sports are so important culturally and they do have these platforms, and seeing them use it for good and speaking out, it just really heartens me right now.
We've had the conversation that we could have a show. We talk about sports scores and highlights and everything that happens that we're interested in. Mm-hmm. But really, oftentimes, the conversations we really want to have, or the stuff that you write about a lot, is about how sports and culture intersect, mm-hmm. and gender. Mm-hmm. And so I think it is really important to have that conversation. And we want to explore more of that in this space.
Yeah.
You also know a vast array of authors and experts, and including someone who we're going to talk with next week. Can you give us kind of like a little bit of background of who we're going to interview for next week?
Yeah, absolutely. So Latoya Brackett is a Black Studies professor down at University of Puget Sound, who I had the opportunity to meet a couple weeks ago. And, you know, she has done some amazing work researching, you know, the impact that protest has on Black athletes. So we're gonna chat with her next week a little bit about, you know, the context, the historical context of Olympic athletes, you know, really protesting their own governments, their own countries, and what they're putting at risk, right? And I'm really looking forward to talking with Latoya next week. While we plan our future shows, you know, we really want to know what we're missing. We want to know what you guys are thinking about, what stories you want to hear here on The Forecast. What do you want to know about Seattle women's sports? What are you watching that we're missing? Go ahead and send us an email at theforecast@kvru.org with your thoughts and questions or suggestions and story ideas. You might just get a call from us so that we can talk women's sports. This is Maggie Mertens, and you're listening to KVRU 105.7's The Forecast. We had the opportunity to chat with a local Olympian, Eunice Lee, a short track speed skater who's currently competing over in Milan. Eunice got her start with the Puget Sound Speed Skating Club down in Tacoma, and we spoke with her a week before she left for Italy. You can catch her this Saturday, February 14th, during the women's 3,000-meter relay. Welcome to the show, Eunice.
Hi, Maggie. Thank you for having me.
Tell me just about what you're going into this Olympics with in terms of, you know, this is your second time. Is there anything that you feel like I'm going to do something differently this time around?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's definitely different, just because the last time was really just an experience for me to kind of observe, which I'm still super grateful for. But the girls that were on the team had so much experience and kind of knowledge about racing and just all these competitions. It was like my trip to Beijing was literally the first competition that I ever went to abroad for skating. So it was just something that was kind of, I felt almost like a spectator, which I was still part of the team, but it was definitely a different experience. And so for this games, it's definitely more of I am preparing myself for what I know that I need to do. Also, just allowing myself to kind of understand and be okay with where I'm at in terms of my skating and my fitness and capabilities, just because I know leading up to this season, like last season, I wasn't skating at all and the kinds of things that I was dealing with. So it's definitely kind of a, I know what I need to do and I'm going to put myself in the best position to be able to do my job, but, you know, I'm not going to put myself under too much pressure to have things a certain way by the time that I'm competing.
Tell me about what events you've qualified for here for the upcoming Milan Cortina Games. I'm really excited. I'm sure you're excited to kind of be back and, you know, be a little older and a little wiser. So tell me about what you're looking forward to and where you'll be competing.
Right. So for this games, I'm a relay specialist, so I'll just be competing in the 3000 relay with the women. And it's definitely different from last time. Last time I was more so having the role of an alternate, just because, you know, like I came on to the team for the first time at Olympic trials and then we left for Beijing about a month later. But this time I'll be competing with the girls in the relay, as far as I know. And we have a really strong relay team. I think this season and just the squad in general. And so I'm super excited.
What does the relay competition format consist of at the Olympics?
So it's four women, and usually there's four countries competing at the same time. And every person will skate 1.5 laps and then exchange or do a relay exchange with the next person who comes out. And then the first two people will do a total of 5 exchanges and the next two people will do a total of 4. And so in total, that amounts to 27 laps, and that's why it's called the 3K relay. It's fast paced, definitely, just because individually you're either only skating 6 laps or 7.5 laps. And so splitting that up over the course of around four minutes, like people can go pretty fast. And so it's definitely a race of strategy, positioning, and just a lot of speed.
Yeah, incredible. That sounds like such an athletic feat too, to kind of like sprint, rest, sprint, rest, sprint, rest. What kind of, you know, what's the key to being successful in a relay like that in terms of, you know, what are the techniques you kind of have to deploy to like make sure everything goes off smoothly?
In a race that goes by so quickly and you're exchanging so quickly with your teammates, so each lap is around 9 seconds. So you're on, you know, like you're skating for a total of like maybe 15 seconds and then you have to immediately push your teammate. Timing is super important just because the speed at which you're coming out, where exactly you're exchanging on the track can make or break your positioning for the next exchange. And so trying to have that down super, you know, like trying to make our team as ready as possible for any kind of situation is super important. And so it's definitely a lot about timing, building up the right amount of speed, and also staying, putting yourself in the right place on the track so that you can, you know, stay tight and prevent other countries from passing up or getting themselves into a better position.
That's always the big thing in speed skating, right, is like how to pass and like whether you can actually get around them and without crashing or causing these big things. Are there any big rivalries or something that, you know, you are personally sort of looking for on the track during this relay?
No rivalries, I think. There's so many strong countries that I think for every round of the relay, we're just focused on, you know, making it out. And then, well, I guess there's only one qualifying round this time. It's starting from the semifinals. And then whoever can make it into the final will potentially, you know, could win a medal. And so I think just going into the games, my mindset is just like, whether I'm in the semi or the final, just do the best job that I can do and do my role so that we you know, make it into the final, or we put ourselves in a position to get a medal.
How do you deal with that mentally? Like, what's your outlook going in, you know, going over to Italy? How do you kind of like keep yourself calm and relaxed with all that unknown up in the air?
Yeah, so I think, I mean, with skating, you never have a sense of certainty, and that's the same for individual events or team events. Even if you are the best prepared that you could possibly be, like, unforeseen things can just blow up a race, or unforeseen things could help you make it past certain rounds. And so I think there's no point in worrying about things that are going to be out of my control, but the things that I do know for sure that I want to be in the best place physically and mentally that I can be, so that I'm ready for anything to happen, I guess. And so I think right now, going into practices and kind of preparing to take off with the team in the next 2 weeks, I'm just in the mindset of I want to prioritize each practice so that I can skate the relay better. What is going to help my speed? What is going to help my timing? And I guess that's kind of all I'm thinking about, just so that when the time comes, I'll know that I did everything within my power to kind of prepare myself for the situation that I'm going to be in.
Well, thank you so much for joining us here on The Forecast. I'm Maggie Mertens, and I've been talking here today with Eunice Lee, short track speed skater headed to Milan. I'm not going to lie. I am not a Kraken fan. I'm sorry. It's not their fault even. It's just that as a longtime Seattle Storm fan, I felt like Kraken came in and kind of took over that arena that was supposed to be the Storm's new home and made it all about them. I mean, for the first season that the Storm played at Climate Pledge, they didn't even have a space in the team store for Storm merchandise. You had to go to a little pop-up stand, you know, out in the stands, and it was ridiculous. This was 2022, not that long ago. Plus, I just have a lot of mixed feelings about the NHL. But when I heard PWHL was expanding into Seattle, I was really thrilled, because I've been following women's hockey for a long time, and it has been a long, difficult road for these players. There have been several iterations of women's professional hockey leagues here in the U.S., and all of them have struggled. The PWHL has really turned that around in a lot of ways. The players are generally paid at least a living wage. The minimum is $35,000, with at least six players on each team making at least $80,000. These are not male professional sports figures, of course, but we do see promise in them as a very basic starting point. So it did take me a few months to get to a Torrent game in person. I ended up going to the game against the Boston Fleet on January 18th. My husband and I made a date night out of it, which meant we parked 30 minutes before the game, eight blocks away, and spent 2 minutes getting burgers at Dick's and ate them on our way to the entrance. I'm used to the way Climate Pledge is set up for Storm games. Now, they don't even open all of the seats for those games. And this is an extremely successful franchise that's been around for two decades, almost 30 seasons at this point. When the Storm plays in Climate Pledge Arena, they get a bit under 12,000 fans per game on average, which is pretty good for the WNBA. So I went to this Torrent game with that expectation. This is the inaugural season. They're not even halfway through. But the whole thing, it felt like a packed house. There were 12,773 ticket holders in attendance at the game. So more than the average Storm game. The upper levels are always open during Torrent games, where they only open those levels for Storm games on special occasions when they know there will be more demand. I could barely make it into the team store during one of the break periods because the line wrapped all the way back and around the corner just to get in. And once I did get in, I felt like a salmon being pushed along the river past all of the merchandise. I had to kind of like jump out to look at things that I liked. And I was kind of astounded by things like a $110 sweatshirt or two beanies that were black and gray, not even the Torrent's colors. The game itself was so fun. I really love watching hockey. It's so fast-paced. It's obviously physical, but takes such finesse. The crowd was also all in. They would play clips of songs, and the fans would jump in and just keep singing to finish the rest of the verse. There were so many heated rivalry references among fan signs in the crowd. and just the general feeling was very young and fun and queer, and there were kids and families too, but it felt like a fun 20-something thing to do on a weekend night. We sat right in front of a group of college-age kids, only one of whom seemed to know anything about the rules of hockey, but that didn't stop the rest of them from being extremely enthusiastic cheering section and wanting to know what was going on at every moment. One of my favorite ways to get a feel for a sports crowd is who they cheer the loudest for. On this night, the Torrent was celebrating Black history and highlighting the work of organizations like Black Girl Hockey Club. When a young Black poet performed during the first intermission, and the Central District muralist and sneaker designer Takiya Ward was highlighted during the second intermission, people stopped to listen, to remark, and cheer. But the biggest cheer by far of the night was when it was announced that Malala Yousafzai, Nobel Peace Prize winner and advocate for girls' education around the world, was in attendance. She blew the crowd some kisses from her box seat, and all around me were audible gasps of disbelief. It's incredible that someone from that part of the world, from, you know, education, from feminism, who has a Nobel Peace Prize, is the person that this sports crowd was so astounded to see. It made me so happy to hear these young people everywhere being just thrilled that Malala also likes women's hockey. Going to this game was truly a good time. It was engaging, and I felt like I was in that cozy bubble of women's sports fandom that I love. Plus, I got to see some really great hockey. The Torrent was on full blast offensively. They took way more shots on goal than the Fleet did. They were only able to sink one. The Fleet's goalkeeping was exceptional, and they ended up tying the game. The way the PWHL breaks ties is goes to a 5-minute 3-on-3 sudden death overtime. And if no one scores, it's straight to a shootout. The Torrent ended up dropping this one during the shootout, which was a huge bummer. But seeing the huge enthusiasm, the young crowd, and the engagement in this sport that a few years ago was considered super fringe just really showed me how high the watermark has gotten for women's sports and starting new leagues and what's possible for the future. On that note, there's always more than one can see going on in sports under the surface, especially as a casual fan. And this is the kind of show that's going to go deeper than just the scoreboard, so I wanted to bring in my friend and colleague in the trenches of freelance women's sports journalism, Frankie De La Creta, who has done some reporting in recent weeks on certain issues with the PWHL. Thanks so much for joining us here on The Forecast, Frankie.
Thank you for having me.
Amazing. Well, first I wanted to talk to you about something we've talked about many times over the years, which is the idea that the growth of women's sports is amazing. It's something many of us have been rooting for years, but it's not always 100% positive. Can you tell me a little bit about the experience you had recently taking your family to a Boston Fleet game?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think this is something that comes up a lot, particularly because for so long there was so little investment and media attention in women's sports. And so it was very uncritically like, grow the game, like no matter what. And even like in the media itself, I think sometimes there's a lot more cheerleading than actual, you know, reporting for women's sports. And, you know, as someone who has been attending women's sporting events and reporting on them as well, like I'm a fan and a journalist, it's been really interesting to notice the shift as these sports get more mainstream. I have been attending professional women's hockey games in Boston since the first iteration of this league, which was the National Women's Hockey League, like many years ago. They were called the Boston Pride then. I used to go every year for my birthday. But so, you know, women's professional hockey has this long kind of life in Boston, and the fans have been around for a while. And it's been amazing to see the Boston Fleet get as big as they have been and be able to, you know, sell out arenas in Boston. And I'm so excited about the enthusiasm for that. And we actually went, I have two kids, and we went to see the Fleet play the Torrent actually a few weeks ago when they played in the city of Boston, because the Fleet actually play most of their games outside the city. This was one of their Boston games. And it's nice because people who don't always have access to the team come. And I think a lot of people that have never seen sport before will show up. It's a great opportunity for new fans. However, we were seated in front of this man and the woman that he was with. And this man spent the entire game disparaging women's hockey, of making fun of the players, calling the players names, and just really being sexist and horrible. And it was really difficult because I would normally have said something to this person, but I'm with my kids and I don't want to escalate a situation either. And I think that's kind of where you have to make a decision on what to do. But I think it's also really, really jarring because we often, especially as the NHL gets a lot of criticism for the culture, the kind of culture it has, as, you know, heated rivalry has gotten really big and people will say the NHL is homophobic, watch the PWHL. And I think it's really important to say that, like, just because women's sports might be slightly less problematic than men's sports doesn't mean that there are these incredibly perfect safe spaces that are free of, you know, a lot of the problems that exist in the outside world.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, for so many people, I mean, me included, women's sports have traditionally been kind of a haven where we feel like we can be safe, right? Like we won't hear these terrible misogynistic comments from the people around us. Has that been your experience traditionally, or have you started to see that shift in other women's sports as well?
I will say, overall, my experience at women's sporting events has been like immaculate vibes. People are much more supportive of, you know, even opposing players and opposing teams, even if you have a rooting interest. The way that I have found that women's sports fans cheer for just like the game itself is really, really lovely. And that hasn't changed. In general, I'd say the vibe overall is still really, really great. However, I've noticed this in my experiences at WNBA games as well. And in fact, last season, I wrote for Antscape at ESPN about being at a Connecticut Sun Indiana Fever playoff game and how horrific that experience was as a fan, because of so much of the like harassment and like abuse that was being leveled at the players. And so we're seeing this across women's leagues. And I think that's because as the sports grow and attendance increases, you're attracting more, you know, quote unquote, mainstream fans. And what happens is you're then bringing elements, the toxic elements of mainstream culture, into these spaces that have formerly felt like havens from a lot of these things. And so I think it's a really double, you know, the growth of women's sports is really like a double-edged sword in that way.
It seems to me like the PWHL has grown just a ton. You know, you mentioned the NWHL in the previous iterations of these leagues where, you know, they were very niche, very much, you know, trying super hard to bring fans in. The Torrent, you know, is in their first season. They're already getting crowds that are bigger than Storm crowds on average. And it's interesting to me, right? Because the Storm isn't, they're no slouch, right? They're one of the oldest women's franchises. And I'm wondering what you think it is about women's hockey right now that is really drawing people in. And I do wonder how much of it has to do with heated rivalry.
Yeah, I'm actually really curious because I know that they said something like there was like a 40% spike in NHL ticket sales on StubHub since Heated Rivalry debuted. And I also know that a lot of people on social media are encouraging those same, specifically like queer fans, to watch the PWHL as well. So I'm curious to see if the PWHL has seen any similar like spike in tickets. I also think you've got, this is a Winter Olympics year. And so a lot of players from the PWHL, every single women's team in the Winter Olympics this year has at least one current or former PWHL player on it. And so it's, you're going to have this like showcase for a lot of these athletes. And women's hockey is really interesting because on an international stage, like the Team USA, Team Canada rivalry is actually one of the biggest rivalries in international sports, you know, between those two women's teams for, you know, years. The last like two decades, it's been this massive rivalry. And so people have really loved to watch it in Olympic years. You know, the challenge from a professional league was always that it was decentralized. There was all of these different factions that had different leagues, and you couldn't get all of the best players kind of together under one league. And that's what the PWHL has managed to do. I think the PWHL is booming kind of at the right time. You have all of this investment in this league specifically, but also in women's sports across the board. And so it's really kind of the perfect moment for this league to be taking off. And they're taking advantage of that really well. I think the takeover tours are a really great example of that as well. They're, for people that don't know what those are, they the teams are playing in different cities kind of across the US and Canada, where they don't have teams, and drawing massive crowds there as well.
Yeah, it's been really, really incredible to watch, you know, a league kind of do some of the right things when it comes to, like, you know, investing and growing the game. And on that note, you know, nothing is perfect. Women's sports have often also been places for protest and political statements. And so it made sense that, you know, in recent weeks at PWHL games, fans were starting anti-ICE chants, and they've been bringing signs about ICE to games, especially in Minneapolis. But something kind of interesting happened at those Minneapolis Freeze games. Can you tell us a little bit about what your reporting found was going on there?
Yeah, so I think what's really interesting to note about women's sports and activism is, and the PWHL, is that women's hockey tends to be a more politically conservative sport than other ones, like the WNBA is one that comes to mind, and even the NWSL, which is more conservative in, like, the current iteration of soccer players that I think they have, but the previous generation of, you know, women's soccer players in the U.S. are kind of known for their historic pay equity and Megan Rapinoe, you know, kneeling alongside, you know, Colin, in solidarity with Colin Kaepernick for racial justice. And so you have these women's leagues that are known for being progressive, and that is what attracts a lot of the fans. A lot of the people who have been watching these sports for a long time do so because of their perceived, you know, progressive spaces. And women's hockey is definitely more progressive than men's hockey, but it's still a very white sport and a very conservative sport comparatively, which means that the fans who are showing up to watch the game are going to probably skew more liberal than both the majority of the players on the ice and definitely the franchises, because the franchises are corporations. So a lot of the credit we give, like, the WNBA for its activism is the players being activists, and the WNBA kind of just, like, taking the credit for it, you know, it's the corporation isn't the activist here. And so this is kind of the clash that we're starting to see, particularly, I'd say, the Minnesota Frost games have been kind of ground zero for this, because, as we know, they are currently, you know, under ICE occupation, essentially, in the Twin Cities. And there have been at least two community members who have been murdered by the state, you know, on the streets. And so there, aside from the fact that hockey is played on ice and the puns are right there, fans are showing up and they're not going to be silent about what's happening. And I know some Frost fans brought, you know, kind of like ICE out signs, or this is the only ICE we want in Minnesota signs. And they were confiscated by arena security. But then you get into the arena and there's, like, a moment of silence for, you know, Renee Nicole Good, who was murdered. They don't say how she was murdered or who killed her. And, you know, the leagues will say they want to stay out of politics while making kind of a political statement by having this moment of silence. And so there's a bunch of really conflicting messages. And I would say this, of course, is across sports. Like, sports leagues have never really figured out how to occupy this space. But in women's sports, it's a little bit harder because the fans will pressure you in a way that, you know, mainstream men's sports fans are not going to. And where this gets incredibly complicated is when you actually look at the ownership of the PWHL itself. So differently from other leagues like the WNBA, where there's different ownership groups for kind of each team, the PWHL, kind of the league itself, has one ownership group. And the most visible people in that ownership group are Billie Jean King and her wife, who are also, you know, part owners of the LA Dodgers, for example. But the majority of the financing for this league comes from the Mark Walter Group, also a Dodgers owner. And Mark Walter is the CEO of two companies, Guggenheim Partners and TWG Global. And those companies invest in ICE. One company invests in Palantir, which provides the tech that's used to surveil and monitor immigrants. And the other company invests in, you know, one of the largest private prison corporations who has major contracts building and maintaining ICE detention centers. So there's a direct conflict of interest in terms of why the league might not want their fans to be protesting ICE when the owner of all of the teams actually is helping to fund it.
Yeah, I was so impressed and, you know, horrified to read your reporting about that ownership structure, and just, you know, being able to follow the money like that, I think is so important for fans, and thinking about it with a grain of salt, like you're saying. You know, I think the Torrent fan base is pretty typical for what we're probably seeing around the country for PWHL, you know, pretty young, pretty queer, lots of women and families. For these fans, why do you think these financial connections are kind of important to bear in mind?
I think that we often have this tendency to pedestal women's sports as kind of these unequivocal, like, goods. And I think the thing to remember is that we're living under late stage capitalism and billionaires are funding these leagues. And unfortunately, billionaires generally did not become billionaires by never doing shady things or having completely wonderful ties to their, you know, monetary connections. So the money has to come from somewhere. And you can look at any of these leagues and be like, ooh, that's kind of not great, right? You can look at a lot of the investors in the WNBA and their ties to, like, you know, Israel and Israeli, you know, money coming in that way. And anyway, any billionaire who you look too closely at their investments, there's going to be red flags. And so I don't want the perfect to be the enemy of the good. I also don't want to say that we should let these leagues off the hook and that I don't think that fan pressure matters, because I think that it really, really does. I think that it's important. But I think I would say to remember that kind of everyone is flawed and nothing is perfect. And I think what I would always say is support the players over, like, the franchise, right? The players are the people that you're there to, like, show up and support. And, you know, they are the ones that this growth really benefits. They are the ones that are finally going to be able to be paid to play professional hockey when just a few years ago, most of them were not making enough to be able to do it full time. And so it's really like, this is who that is for. And I think remembering that, right? Don't be a simp for the franchise. They don't need that, you know. Stand up for the players and stand behind them, and, like, you know, then you'll be in the right place.
I love that. Is there anything else on the PWHL front that you think people should know about? I didn't ask about.
I think the only other thing that I would mention that has been on the radar recently and is kind of always simmering on the back burner is the fact that the PWHL currently does not have a gender inclusion policy of any kind, which is interesting because the league that this was before it was the PWHL, the PHF, had not only had a policy, but they had one of the more inclusive policies, particularly in the last year of their existence. I actually did some reporting on inclusion policies for Sports Illustrated back in 2021. And as a result of that story, the PHF actually updated their policy to be more inclusive. And that was really lovely. And I think a lot of fans have hoped that the PWHL would follow suit in some way. They haven't. And I will say that's not necessarily a bad thing. Sometimes, like, the WNBA doesn't have a policy either. Sometimes when there is a policy in place, then it eliminates people. Without a policy, there's really, like, kind of, you know, everyone's sort of included, right? However, I would say that with the way that hockey itself is trending right now when it comes to inclusivity, you know, kind of seems to be trending in the wrong direction. USA Hockey, which is separate from, you know, the PWHL. However, players who are in the PWHL play for Team USA, right? They're going to the Olympics. You know, USA Hockey just quietly banned trans athletes from all levels of competition, including club and amateur levels. Like, you know, you can't even join a club league at this point under their new policy. And I haven't seen any PWHL players speak out about that. And so, you know, they're going to the Olympics wearing Team USA after this just happened. And I think it's important to note that while women's hockey is a very inclusive space and the fandom is really inclusive and there's a lot of openly queer players, it's a very different reality for trans athletes and the support for trans athletes. And so that is something I'm kind of quietly watching as well.
Yeah, that's super important. Thank you so much for joining us, Frankie. Can you let us know where people can find your work?
Absolutely. The best place to find me is at my queer sports newsletter. It is called Out of Your League. And I'm on all social platforms at the Frankie DLC.
Amazing. Thank you so much. We'll be sure to link.
Thank you.
And that's our show. Thanks so much for listening. Thank you to KVRU 105.7 for having us. We're so happy to be here. I'm Maggie Mertens, and the show is produced by Jeff Shaw, and we will be back next week.